This is Colorado Edition from KUNC. On today's show, there's talk of a wall along Colorado's border.
And we're building a wall on the border of New Mexico. And we're building a wall in Colorado.
Though the president said he was kidding when he said that, we'll hear about a Colorado politician who was serious about that idea almost a century ago.
Plus, we take a look at why you may not be able to see the Denver Nuggets on TV this season.
That's coming up. It's Thursday, October 24th. You're listening to KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Colorado sports can be a touchy subject for longtime fans who have been through the ups and the downs. But no matter where you stand, it's going to be a little harder to keep up with your favorite Centennial State squad this year, whether it's the Nuggets or the Avalanche.
Yeah, that's because of an ongoing dispute among local cable companies and the network that carries those teams. It's complicated stuff, but thankfully, KUNC's Desmond O'Boyle has been looking into all of that for us. So I've got my snacks and I've got my soda, but I still can't watch these games at home. Why?
Essentially, the regional sports network industry is in turmoil right now.
Over the last two decades, Altitude has provided quality award-winning programming. But Comcast, DirecTV, and Dish Network has decided to stop you from watching your hometown teams by blocking the Nuggets.
That includes networks like Altitude. They cover the Nuggets, Colorado Avalanche hockey team, Colorado Rapids soccer team, and Colorado Mammoth. That's the lacrosse team. Altitude distributes the games to Comcast, Dish, and DirecTV, and they have not been able to come to a new contract agreement. So the channel is blacked out right now.
Why haven't they been able to come to an agreement?
I took that question to Michael Singer. He covers the Nuggets for the Denver Post and has been writing about the dispute between Altitude and distributors. It basically comes down to cost.
Obviously, you've heard the term cord cutters. That is driving the entire turmoil in the industry. People are tired of paying exorbitant fees for regional sports networks in their cable bill when these distributors claim that their subscribers aren't watching these games.
Colorado is front and center for this issue right now, and Singer says other sports markets are watching how this plays out closely.
So fans in Colorado can't watch their favorite teams unless all this gets resolved. But how did we get to this point?
It has come into question why Altitude let all the contracts expire at the same time. Matt Hutchins is the chief operating officer for Kroenke Sports and Entertainment. That's the parent company of Altitude. He says contracts are typically renewed every 5 years or so, with carriers increasing the rates. This year, they said no to the increases, and that's just part of it.
Number two is two of these carriers, Comcast and AT&T DirecTV, they own and operate regional sports networks throughout the country. And we know that they have not asked and they are not requiring their own networks to take the terms of what they put forward to us, and nor are they requiring each other.
So the main providers have special deals with their own sports networks. Think FS1 or NBC Sports. And Hutchins says those deals aren't the same as what the carriers are offering Altitude. Basically, that's why we're at an impasse with the contract dispute. Now, we've reached out to Comcast for their take on things. They sent us an emailed statement. It says they know how much fans want to see their teams and, quote, "We want to do what's right for our customers. We've provided a partial credit to the regional sports network fee, and that is reflected on the customer's bill under the credit portion of the bill." So it's basically a refund that they're giving back to some of their customers, a small refund for not being able to see it. And I should note, Comcast is an underwriter with KUNC.
What can I really do to see these games then? Could I just go to a sports bar?
Not exactly. Most of them utilize those major carriers. I asked Michael Singer about this too.
They're not good. You can buy a ticket to the game. As Nuggets coach Michael Malone told me a week ago, that was one option. Unfortunately, there are illicit streams that people have chosen to use. The problem is that if you buy League Pass for the NBA, it is blacked out if you are in the Denver metro area.
There are some smaller cable providers that did come to a contract extension with Altitude, but they're lesser known and not quite as utilized, like CenturyLink, Charter, or TDS Broadband. You might be able to watch the games on other networks like ESPN or by listening on the radio. For the Nuggets home opener on Friday, Altitude TV purchased airtime on KTVD. That's a local station on Channel 20. It's the first time in more than 30 years they'll be aired on a local network broadcast.
How long can this holdout really last between Altitude and cable providers?
In theory, the entire season. However, Singer thinks they may be able to come to a one-year stopgap extension to further work out details. Also, Altitude has reached out to Hulu and Amazon as a streaming option, but Matt Hutchins told me those options haven't been found to be economically viable for Altitude yet. So until further notice, we are stuck not watching the Avs and Nuggets on TV if you have Dish, Comcast, or DirecTV.
Thanks, Desmond.
You're welcome.
Now let's take a look at today's headlines.
Park County School District teachers are back on the job after a 10-day strike, but they went back to the classroom today without a new contract. Chalkbeat Colorado reports that union members are looking ahead to November's school board elections. Teachers are also seeking an independent investigation from the Department of Labor into the school district's abilities to pay teachers more. However, both the union and the school district would have to approve before state intervention can occur. Teachers were striking for higher wages and more financial transparency from the district.
Saturday is National Drug Take-Back Day, and this year, for the first time, people can securely dispose of certain e-cigarette devices. Drug Take-Back Day has been used to dispose of old or expired prescription medications or over-the-counter drugs to avoid sending them to landfills or the local water supply. This year, people can drop off vaping devices and cartridges. The move comes as public officials have issued warnings about a mysterious lung illness related to vaping. Colorado has one of the highest youth vaping rates in the country. At least 9 cases of vaping-related illnesses have been reported in Colorado so far.
As winter storms arrive, it appears a new traction law passed by state lawmakers this year may not be sticking with some drivers. I-70 saw multiple closures this week, and the Colorado Department of Transportation is, in part, blaming that on drivers who don't have the right tires for snowy conditions. The new law says drivers must carry chains or have adequate tires on the mountain stretch of I-70 from September through the end of May.
And speaking of mountain roads, a popular high-altitude road in Rocky Mountain National Park closed for the season today. Sections of the 48-mile Trail Ridge Road, which links Estes Park to Grand Lake, will remain open to vehicles, but are subject to closures as winter conditions move in. Almost 200 years ago, the U.S. government and hunters began slaughtering bison on the Great Plains. The animals were close to extinction, but now a wealthy nonprofit is trying to bring them back by stitching together a privately funded national park in Montana. With support from the Pulitzer Center, Nate Hedgie has more for KUNC.
The Fort Belknap Indian Reservation is sheltered in the shadow of the Little Rocky Mountains. In the winter there, the air gets so cold it hurts the back of your throat when you breathe. Everything is frozen, seems dead. But in late July, the grasses grow green and tall, and folks are all gathered together near the town of Lodgepole for a powwow. When I arrive, a thunderstorm is building in the distance, and the air is thick with humidity. Kids and families are everywhere. Generators hum from the backs of trailers. I grab a greasy hamburger from a food stand and strike up a conversation with its cook, Hannah Hazeagle. She's Nakota and says she'd much rather be serving hamburgers made from bison rather than beef.
We can fill up cans and cans of fat, but with that buffalo, you don't even get a quarter in the can of fat.
It's lean meat.
Yeah, it's straight lean, yeah.
She says it's a healthier food for people on a reservation to eat. And that's a big reason why she's excited about American Prairie Reserve. The proposed 3.2 million acre, privately funded wildlife sanctuary is planning to reintroduce thousands of genetically pure bison back to the Great Plains.
It's probably a blessing to have all those buffalo. It ain't probably, it is.
That's because for centuries, the lives of plains tribes and bison were braided together. The people relied on the animals for everything. So when the U.S. government and white settlers began their mass slaughter of the bison in the 19th century, it was like they were tearing out the tribe's heart. Kenneth Tuffy Helgeson is Nakota. He sums it up best with stories his grandfather told him.
The buffalo to the Indian is a symbol of God. And when they tried to eradicate the Indian, they knew if they took away our main food source, our main symbol of God, that we would be rendered to literally nothing.
Helgeson is a fourth-generation rancher here on the reservation. He's wearing a crisp white shirt, flat-brim hat, and blue jeans. He says the stories of bison and tribes mirrored each other after that slaughter. Wild bison were confined within a single national park, Yellowstone.
At the same time, Indians were put on a reservation in their own kraals, and our populations dwindled.
Helgeson's family and many others were encouraged to cultivate the land, like white people do.
And we were given a plow and a horse and a bit and a bridle and a few head of cows to make a life for ourselves to the word they used in those days was to assimilate the Indian, to take away their culture, to give them a new culture.
The culture of ranching. And that culture has held power over the West for more than 150 years. Helgeson feels for the local ranching community, with American Prairie Reserve purchasing many of their spreads. Cattlemen are losing their neighbors and their way of life. But Helgeson also understands why some folks on the reservation don't have a lot of sympathy for them.
So in a lot of ways, a person may think, you're going to get your comeuppance and we're going to settle up and you're going to feel what we felt.
Now, not everyone feels that way. There are a lot of different opinions about American Prairie Reserve on the reservation. But Helgeson says the times are changing and the world is evolving. Right now, it's evolving in the tribe's favor. They're gaining a crucial piece of their culture back. American Prairie's wild herd will be the largest one in the lower 48. But the coin hasn't completely flipped. The tribes are able to hunt bison on reserve lands, but they currently have to pay a fee to do it. You see, American Prairie isn't giving tribes their traditional lands back. It plans to keep them, so it can have a louder voice in how this patchwork of private and public lands are managed.
That is traditional land for the Nakota, the Ani, the Blackfeet. Do you think that they should hand that land back over to the tribes? Is that the right thing to do?
You know, I believe, my friend, that in our old songs, our old teachings, there's one song that our people sing, and it says, "My friend, don't be foolish. The only thing that lives forever is the earth." We can fight over land, we can fight over dirt, we can fight over all these things, but really all you ever have is what's on your shoes. That's the only dirt that you'll ever own. The only ground that you'll ever own is on your shoes, and that'll fall off too.
For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie.
You can find all the stories in our series, The Next Yellowstone, at our website, KUNC.org.
And you're listening to Colorado Edition from KUNC.
The city of Boulder is exploring a new program which would offer additional funding to middle-income earners looking to purchase a home. Although the program is still in its infancy, Boulder voters have the power to stop the plan in its tracks this November. Joining us now to tell us more is Sam Lounsbury, a reporter with the Boulder Daily Camera. Hey, Sam.
Hey.
So let's start with a brief description of the program itself. What do we know about what's being proposed?
So what's being proposed on the ballot is just permission for the city of Boulder to take out up to $10 million in debt. And if voters approve the city to do that, the city would use that debt to help out people who are looking to buy a home in Boulder who might not be able to afford to get what they could in maybe Lafayette or Longmont, you know, kind of nearby municipalities. They might be able to get something similar to what they could get nearby in Boulder if the city could kind of use that debt to kind of supplement what buyers could get in a loan from the private sector.
So it sounds like, you know, maybe they would qualify for X amount and the home that they want to purchase is X plus a bit. This program would kind of be used to make up the difference. Is that right?
Exactly. So what the city has kind of been using as an example is someone who might be able to afford a $30,000 down payment as a 5% kind of upfront payment for a $600,000 home in Boulder, they might be approved for like $432,000 in a loan from, you know, a commercial lender. So how do you get that extra $138,000 to kind of back your purchase? Well, the city is proposing that it would step in and provide that additional about 23% of the loan. And it would, for anyone who wants to enter this program, not require any payments back to the city for the first 10 years.
And then after that, they would repay this like another mortgage kind of?
Exactly. It would be a balloon payment after that 10-year period.
Right. Well, what have the reactions been to this program?
They are kind of different depending on who you ask. The city council members who proposed this, Sam Weaver and Bob Yates, they've kind of said, hey, there's really not a lot of risk in approving this, because if there are no takers, for this program, then it's just a debt that we have available that we don't really draw down on. And it would allow the city to kind of tweak the program to potentially make it more attractive if there's no interest in it right away. At the same time, there are real estate experts, kind of some residents, who are saying this is a valiant effort. We agree that there needs to be something done to kind of help out the kind of middle class in Boulder. You know, they have what city officials feel like is a pretty strong assistance program for low-income folks. Obviously, people who are wealthy can afford Boulder, but they feel like it's the middle that's kind of being, you know, priced out of Boulder a little bit more.
Boulder voters will decide next month whether to allow the city to take on more debt to do this. What happens after that?
If it's approved, then the program is essentially created. You know, they kind of figure out the details. How much would we allow homes to appreciate annually for any that are bought using, you know, the city's kind of money as a backup loan? You know, what do we do for folks who, after that 10-year period, maybe can't afford to pay back the city all at once for what they got up front? There's been talk of, you know, finding ways to, you know, exempt people that are kind of experiencing some sort of hardship that disallows them from paying back the city right away at that 10-year mark. You know, kind of working out the details of what would happen in those types of situations. Obviously, the, you know, tool that I think people would kind of fall back on at that 10-year period when the balloon payment to the city is due is refinancing, you know, with the equity that they've built up over, you know, the first 10 years of owning their home.
Sam Lounsbury is a reporter for the Boulder Daily Camera. Sam, thank you so much for breaking this down.
Thank you so much for having me, Aaron. Really appreciate it.
President Trump gave a speech in Pittsburgh yesterday where he broached the subject of a border wall.
And we're building a wall on the border of New Mexico. And we're building a wall in Colorado. We're building a beautiful wall, a big one that really works, that you can't get over, you can't get under.
Colorado, of course, does not share a border with Mexico. Now, we should note here that the president later tweeted that he was kidding when he said that. But that didn't stop the Twitterverse from having a lot of fun with it. It spawned not one, but two Twitter hashtags. And a few Colorado politicians weighed in, too.
Governor Jared Polis tweeted, well, this is awkward. Colorado doesn't border Mexico. Good thing Colorado now offers free full-day kindergarten so our kids can learn basic geography.
Representative Diana DeGette tweeted, is New Mexico going to pay for it?
Well, laughs aside, as it turns out, the idea of a wall along Colorado's border isn't a new one. In the 1930s, Colorado had a governor, Edwin C. Johnson, who wanted to build a wall between the Centennial State and New Mexico. And Aaron, back when you hosted Morning Edition on KUNC, you spoke to then-state historian Patty Limerick about Johnson and his idea for this Colorado wall.
Yeah, I did. It was right before the 2016 presidential election when the idea of a wall at the southern border was also a divisive topic. Here's that interview. So we're going to talk about Edwin C. Johnson, also known as Big Ed. He represented Colorado in the U.S. Senate for three terms, and he was governor of Colorado not once but twice, once in the 1930s, and then again about two decades later in the 50s. So who was Big Ed? He sounds like quite a character.
He was a Democrat, very opposed to the New Deal, struggling with federal authority repeatedly on many different issues. One of the ways that Big Ed Johnson rejected federal authority was on issues of immigration. Initially, he wrote a number of letters to federal authorities saying, please, you must save us from these aliens. We have aliens coming into Colorado, and they are disrupting our opportunities for legitimate Coloradans to get jobs, aliens and indigent persons. We have an invasion, he said, to use that kind of language. Mm-hmm. So he wrote to the federal government and did not get satisfaction. did not get responses that he found to be valuable. So in 1936, on April 18th, he said he was going to be taking action. He would jump right in and proclaim martial law and order the National Guard, the Colorado National Guard, to seal Colorado's southern border with New Mexico. Not Mexico, not the nation, okay, but to close the border with New Mexico.
Wait a minute. Okay, he wanted to seal the border between Colorado and New Mexico? And yes, that's where he felt the, quote, indigents were coming from?
The aliens and indigent persons were crossing the border from New Mexico into Colorado. So on April 20th, General Neil Kimball had set up Camp Johnson near Raton Pass. He was stopping people in cars. As you came up to that camp, there was a sign that said, "Martial law, slow, stop." He and his troops were checking people and sending people with little money or non-citizens back to New Mexico. There were guardsmen stopping trains and taking indigents, what they considered indigents, off the trains and having them walk back to New Mexico.
Wow.
There were airplanes monitoring the state border. General Kimball also sent spies into New Mexico to anticipate the movements of these people. It's really quite a remarkable thing.
Like, that is just fascinating to me. So I imagine there was a lot of talk about it. Probably he had supporters and detractors for this idea.
The New Mexico political figures were pretty smart about how they responded. They responded fast and forcefully and said that they did not think this was the right thing to be doing. And the New Mexico governor took an angle of saying, well, then we'll just prohibit imports from Colorado. And that, in fact, created some unhappiness on the part of Colorado farmers who had products they wanted to market. So there was this kind of fine instant turnabout as fair play. Okay, you want to do that to us. Let's see what you can do to you.
Yeah.
And so by April 30th, just 10 days into this, we'll say, experiment, Governor Johnson lifted martial law and made a most preposterous and amusing announcement by which he said, and I'm quoting here because I had to write this down to make sure I didn't paraphrase this inaccurately, "Colorado has always been a good neighbor, and we must not alienate the friendship of our sister states."
Mm-hmm.
Some Coloradans were not happy with this action, and yet it was also an era where, for instance, at that very time, there were a group putting bright orange placards around the state that had the words that this was a warning to all Mexican and all other aliens to leave the state of Colorado at once by order of Colorado state vigilantes. So there certainly were people who were not only supporting Ed Johnson, but moving past Ed Johnson's position in terms of sort of citizen threats and citizen activism.
Yeah.
And in some ways, this has this border thing has some comic opera qualities of just how peculiar to set up this little thing between two states and then act as if it carried authority. And of course, it's not within the constitutional powers of a state to do such a thing.
Hmm. I'm curious. I know you said that it only lasted about 10 days. What happened after that? I mean, did the issue ever get resolved?
Apparently not. It's 2016. We're still in there, still trying to figure out how the Supreme Court has had a couple of interesting decisions about the powers of states and localities to regulate immigration, all those questions about what the police forces, local police forces can do in the way of targeting suspected illegal aliens. And there's a very clear constitutional reality that's immigration is a federal domain, an area of federal jurisdiction, but the whole big question of federalism and how much power could still remain in the hands of states and municipalities and counties and so on, occasionally still just flares up. It's still an unsettled question about what politicians responding to audible citizen complaint, what they might try to do. It's nothing to go calm and accepting of saying, well, that got worked out. Big Ed Johnson, April 30th, 1936, he dropped his campaign to close the border between Colorado and New Mexico, and he made a nice statement about being good neighbors. So that settled that. It's what it means to be a good neighbor, one state to another, but also one nation to another. We're still working on that.
That was Patty Limerick, who heads the Center of the American West at the University of Colorado Boulder. We spoke in 2016.
So we've quickly arrived at the end of our show today, and sometimes after a long week of news, we like to slow things down a bit. set the tone for the weekend, and spend some time talking about the arts. Today, we're joined by Ron Bostwick, morning show host at our sister station, 105.5, The Colorado Sound. Ron is here to tell us a little more about the new Neil Young album, which comes out tomorrow, Colorado, and the companion documentary called Mountaintop, which is all about the making of said album. Ron, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
So, your first thoughts after seeing the film?
You know, I went into this film not being a big Neil Young fan, but that didn't stop me because there's so much talk about Neil continuing to be productive and being creative that I had to see what this film was all about. And it really wasn't what I expected. It was more of a fly on the wall thing. They set up GoPro cameras all around the studio and just let them run. We really got to see kind of how Neil creates. I call it, in typical Neil Young fashion, it's capricious creativity. You know, Neil really is kind of on the fly. He decides something and wants it done right then. And it creates a little bit of a problem for the engineer. You see him get very exasperated a little bit. The guy who produced the album has worked with Neil for, 35 years, I think. He worked with R.E.M. and with Robin Hitchcock. Neil still gets on his nerves. Mm-hmm. Let's put it this way. And it's really just a chance for you to see how Neil works in the studio. It really confirms my opinion that he's the father of grunge, because the music itself is really crunchy. It's there. It's energetic. It has nothing to do with Neil's age. He's really strong about all of it.
Well, let's pivot to the album, of course, associated with the film. It's called Colorado, recorded in Telluride. Let's hear about this Colorado connection.
Well, it really, I think I went in expecting a little bit more of the Colorado connection, but it comes from the fact that it was recorded at this place called Studio in the Clouds outside of Telluride. And for those of us on the Front Range, we're very familiar with Caribou Ranch outside of Nederland, and it's sort of similar to that. It's one house. You live right there. It's a five-bedroom house. You come downstairs, and the living room is the recording studio. So it's really close in. Everybody hangs out. Now, these are all old friends. Crazy Horse has been recording with Neil for more than 40 years. So they all know each other really, really well. I had to laugh that they have a little bit of an oxygen party at one point, because everybody has portable oxygen tanks, and they all sort of stop and go, hey, let's have an oxygen party. And they all take a quick hit on it. So it's really just the fact that it was recorded in Colorado. It's got some beautiful time-lapse photography at night of the sky and of the terrain. It's really pretty in that way, but the Colorado connection is really the fact that they recorded it down there outside of Telluride.
And what about the music? Are you going to check out the album tomorrow?
You know, I've not been a big Neil fan. I think that he does what he does really, really well, but as some people would say, it's not my cup of tea.
Okay. Ron, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Henry.
And that's our show for today. Be sure to join us Monday as we kick off Halloween week with a look at how corn mazes are designed and built. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Henry Zimmerman. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson. Brian Larson is our executive producer. Our theme music was composed by Colorado musicians Brianna Harris and Johnny Burrows.
Thanks for listening. This is Colorado Edition from KUNC.